You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. As President Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton spent many of his 453 days in the room where it happened, which also happens to be the title of his new book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. In the book, he shows a president addicted to chaos who embraced our enemies and spurned our friends, was deeply suspicious of his own government, and for whom getting reelected was the only thing that mattered, even if it meant endangering or weakening the nation. Almost from its inception, the book touched off a war of words between the president and his former advisor, with Trump denouncing Bolton as a traitor, threatening to throw him in prison, and alternately claiming that Bolton's memoir is full of lies and/or classified information. But John Bolton says the facts speak for themselves. And today, Ambassador Bolton joins me on the show to reveal what he witnessed during his 17 tumultuous months in the Trump White House. We talk about President Trump's bizarre obsession with authoritarian strongmen and his overall lack of interest in advancing freedom and human rights. Bolton reveals how he reacted to Trump's eagerness to meet with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, why the second North Korea summit was put together so hastily, and what took place behind closed doors in Trump's infamous one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. He says the president rarely ever reads, recalls his frustrations at trying to educate Trump about history and foreign policy, and opens up about the numerous times he considered resigning as Trump's national security advisor before he finally reached his breaking point. Plus, he weighs in on whether Trump would willingly step down if defeated in November. Coming up with Ambassador John Bolton in just a moment. John Bolton has spent many years of his career in public service and held high-level positions in the administrations of Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. He served as the United States Ambassador to the United Nations from 2005 to 2006 and is the former National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump, an experience that he writes about in his explosive new book titled The Room Where It Happened, a White House Memoir. Ambassador Bolton, thanks for joining me.
Well, glad you invited me. Glad to be here.
Well, Ambassador Bolton, this book has gotten a ton of attention and has been the subject of much speculation really since the beginning of the year. The president has attacked you, calling you a traitor and saying that this book is full of lies and classified information, but you defend it as a factual account of your 17 months as Trump's national security advisor. And I have to say that some of the revelations in here strike me as highly credible and honestly, absolutely stunning. Now, it's been well documented that for you, the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, was Trump's plan to hold peace talks with the Taliban at Camp David just days before 9/11. However, you say in the book that it was hardly the first time that you considered resigning. How many times in those 17 months did you almost resign? And what were the events that caused you to think about stepping down each time?
Well, it was a long series of events. It wasn't. It's not nearly as dramatic as the West Wing of histrionics and whatnot. It's a thought process, and it's a personal calculation as to how much you think you can continue to contribute on the issues you're responsible for, versus watching the president behave in the way that he did. It really was a series of basically philosophical and substantive differences, but compounded by the president's unstructured, disorderly way of going about decision making. So you put all that together, and eventually it got to the point where I just felt there wasn't anything further I was contributing.
And you say in here that one of the biggest sources of frustration for you was the president's astounding ignorance of policy and history and just general lack of interest in learning the information necessary to enact an effective agenda, to work with his own military and intelligence officials, and to engage productively with other world leaders. You describe a president who rarely reads, only holds intelligence briefings once or twice a week, doesn't really pay attention, trusts his personal friends and Fox News pundits more than his own advisors, and just exhibits a fundamental lack of curiosity about the things that a president ought to know. That has to have made your job all the more difficult. So when you needed to get Trump's attention on something or explain a particular geopolitical situation or policy, how would you go about that with him?
Well, I tried to learn a little bit from the experience of my predecessors and others who had been in the White House. It was clear that he didn't like to listen to long briefings. He certainly didn't read anything at length if it wasn't in a newspaper like the New York Post. He didn't like complex intelligence briefings. Many of the briefings were taken up with him talking, not the intelligence briefer. So I tried to adjust to that personality. I don't think, for example, many people who recommended, well, sitting down in the Situation Room and have long NSC meetings so he'll be brought to the right decision, just doesn't work like that. Doesn't work like that. So I tried to give him what I thought were critical facts. I tried to make sure he knew what the options were, but it was very, very difficult to do anything in a systematic fashion.
You've said that we owe a lot of gratitude to Vice President Pence for the work that he did in private with the president. When someone needed to talk the president out of his worst instincts, was Pence usually the one who filled that role? And does the president respect him enough to actually take his counsel seriously?
Well, I don't want to get Vice President Pence into any more trouble than I probably already put him. You know, he has fulfilled the classic role of a vice president. Unlike the other advisors, Pence can't resign. I mean, he was elected as well, and he's there for 4 years. Nor did he say, you know, I spoke to the president privately. I think he's not that kind of man either. I think a lot of what he did we may never know in full, but I do think the president understood that when the vice president spoke to him privately, he was speaking with what he thought the president's own best interests were. And I think that had a significant impact.
And oftentimes the president appears to lack a coherent policy on a number of issues. For instance, one day he's threatening fire and fury on North Korea, and then he's proclaiming that he and Kim Jong-un are quote unquote in love. There are plenty of examples of him contradicting the official State Department stance on NATO and other issues. And yet Trump's defenders love to say that Trump is playing three-dimensional chess and it's all part of some scheme that the rest of us just aren't smart enough to understand. And they often point to Richard Nixon and the so-called madman theory of diplomacy, that he's supposedly deliberately irrational and unpredictable to put our adversaries on their heels or to dissuade them from any aggressive moves for fear of provoking this highly volatile president. Did you see any evidence of a grand strategy that guides all the tweet storms, the erratic behavior, and policies that seemingly change on a whim?
No, I'm convinced that the only factor that links various decisions together is consideration of the November 3 presidential election. There's a lot of criticism in the press about Trump. You know, he doesn't have a long attention span. He doesn't focus on things and so on. That's not true when it comes to his reelection. His attention span on that is infinite. And that's what worries me as a conservative Republican. It worries me about what will happen after the November election, since so many national security decisions were based, as I lay out in the book, not on the merits of a particular case to do this or do that, but on the expected negative reaction from Republicans in Congress if the president did one particular course. So with that constraint largely removed or certainly minimized once the president's in his second term, I think the policy could be even more untethered than it was in the first term. Mm-hmm.
Well, you described Trump, as you said, as a man who was singularly driven by his own reelection. Let me ask you this. If Donald Trump loses the election in November, can you say with any confidence that he would accept defeat and willingly allow for a peaceful transition of power as every other president has?
Well, the best I can say is I hope that's true. I didn't see any evidence of the inclination not to leave the White House. Mm-hmm. If I did, I would have written about it because I think that would be very serious. Look, as someone who is critical of Trump, I think it's important that criticism be based on reality and on evidence. Mm-hmm. Fear, I understand, but before you, I don't mean you personally, of course, but before people spin up conspiracy theories,
right,
they ought to have some basis in reality. And I think it hurts the critique of the Trump administration to have fantasies that we don't have any basis in evidence for. Mm-hmm.
Well, this may be another fantasy of an entirely different sort, but in recent weeks and months, I've read a number of reports citing anonymous White House sources and senior campaign staff who say the opposite of what we just discussed, that the president's looking at his poll numbers and doesn't have the same fire in his belly as he did in 2016. Maybe he lacks enthusiasm for another term, and he'd rather spend the next 4 years lounging at Mar-a-Lago and playing golf. Or he'd rather resign than face a defeat in November. Indeed, you say in your book, Trump always wanted to be the guy who breaks up with the girl first. So maybe he would rather break up with America than accept the humiliation of a defeat. In the latter months of your time in the White House, did you see anything that might lead you to think that his drive for another term is waning or that he's lost his passion for governing?
I wouldn't describe it as a passion for governing, but I would describe it as a passion for being president.
Okay.
And of course, I've been out of the White House since September. I've read those same those comments to the attributed to anonymous sources. I don't think there's a chance he will withdraw from this race. I think he's busy finding other people to blame for a potential loss, and he's obviously far behind the polls. If he does lose, it won't be his fault. You can count on that. But the chances of him dropping out are less than zero.
Yeah.
And look, I think the election's a toss-up at this point. I think that's the best you can say. We don't know. Trump was behind in 2016, and he won despite the polls.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Well, Ambassador Bolton, I want to get into some specific relationships with other world leaders. There are still so many questions lingering around the opaque relationship between Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Even if we dismiss the question of Russian collusion, it's hard not to wonder why this president remains so deferential to Putin, why he's so adamantly opposed to Russian sanctions or any substantive pushback against Putin. What's your take on that? Do you find his behavior toward Putin difficult to explain?
Well, I think it's very similar in key respects to his behavior toward other authoritarian leaders like Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, Recep Erdogan of Turkey, Maduro of Venezuela, although they've never met. He wants to meet with Maduro. And I'm not a shrink. I can't psychoanalyze him, but I do think he has an affinity as for one big guy talking to another big guy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, before he left in 2018 for a NATO summit, a summit with Theresa May, and the famous Helsinki summit with Putin, he said to the press, leaving the White House, "I think the conversation with Putin may be the easiest of all." Who would have thought that?
Yeah.
And the answer is nobody else would have thought that except for him. And, you know, it's disturbing because these authoritarian leaders on the other side of the table, Putin, Xi, are hardened. They pursue their country's national interests. They may be charming in person, but they never lose sight of what their objective is. And when they sat opposite Donald Trump, it was not a fair fight.
To go back to the Helsinki summit, You recall that you worried about leaving the president alone in the room with Vladimir Putin, but you've also expressed your confidence that nothing untoward happened in their one-on-one meeting. Now, this is one of those rare moments when you weren't in the room where it happened. So how do you know? What do you base that on?
I base it on what our interpreter in the room told the NSC officials with me.
Okay.
It was a 2 hour plus conversation. Now, there's a lot of interpretation going on there, so it's not 2 hours of constant contact. But from everything that we heard from the interpreter and from what both Putin and Trump said in the working lunch we had right after it, and then in the press conference as well, I just breathed a sigh of relief at that point.
Well, moving on to North Korea, there's another one of these strange relationships, the one between Donald Trump and the dear leader Kim Jong-un. You've been very vocal about your stance on North Korea's nuclear ambitions for many years and were critical of the Clinton State Department's so-called basketball diplomacy with Kim's father, Kim Jong-il. What did you say when Trump made the decision to fly all the way to Singapore and meet one-on-one with Kim Jong-un? Did you try to dissuade him?
Well, you know, it was actually announced just before I took the job as National Security Advisor. And as I say in the book, I had qualms immediately. And I took comfort from statements that it didn't represent a change in policy. The Singapore summit, the first of the meetings, almost didn't happen. I recount how that happened in the book. I would have been overjoyed after the president canceled it if he hadn't rescheduled it. I do think the Hanoi summit, the second of the series, was a big win for the United States because the president did what we urged him to do if he didn't get the right kind of deal from North Korea, to walk away, and he did. I'm glad that nothing happened at the DMZ. I hope we don't have an October surprise and a fourth summit where who knows what he'll give away.
Let me ask you this. Why was the second summit so hastily thrown together? I was in Hanoi for that one, and I can recall how the hotels, the local government, and law enforcement were scrambling to get ready, to the point that there were real questions of whether they could guarantee Trump and Kim's safety with so little advance work. I think they only had a week or two of notice, and it appeared very much like a last-minute decision. The media, of course, speculated that it was a last-ditch effort to distract from Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress. Was the summit a last-minute decision? And did Trump ever explain what the rush was and why it had to be that week?
Well, it wasn't so much last minute as there had been back and forth as to where we're going to hold it. And we wanted to go someplace like Geneva or someplace out of Asia. Anyway, when all that got sorted out, that's how it came together. Certainly the president, I think, was distracted by the Cohen testimony. But as I recount in the book, this was a situation where we had prepared him for the possibility of walking away. And he understood it would be the right thing to do. And he went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm. And the president was criticized for focusing entirely on the nuclear negotiations and not bringing up the never-ending humanitarian crisis in North Korea and Kim's record as a prolific human rights violator. Indeed, Trump has been largely silent about human rights abuses in his talks with Saudi Arabia, the Philippines, Russia, and other nations. Only very recently has he said a word about China's crackdown on free speech in Hong Kong and the oppression of Muslim Uyghurs in China. From what you observed of his dealings with other world leaders, and specifically authoritarians and more restrictive governments, do freedom and human rights come up very much? Do those rank very highly on his list of priorities?
I'm on a list of 1 to 10, they may be 11 or 12. That's on a good day. Look, he has now issued sanctions against the Chinese leaders for the repression of the Uyghurs. Steps have been taken with respect to the Chinese, in effect, abrogation of the one country, two systems principle with respect to Hong Kong. And those are the right things to do. But I do believe after the election, if Trump wins, there's every reason to think he will be right back toward pursuing the big deal of the century on trade with China, and those policies could easily be reversed. That's a good example of the impact of domestic political pressure now, which will not exist if he wins re-election.
As I mentioned earlier, the president has accused you of revealing classified information in this book, and he has called you a traitor to your country, even suggesting that you might be prosecuted for what's in here. On the other hand, you have been emphatic that there is nothing classified in here, and from what I've read, I don't really see anything that might be restricted information. Indeed, you've said that if you had put classified information in the book, it might have been 500 pages longer. Without going into details about anything that you can't talk about, are there other things that you witnessed about Donald Trump that you couldn't reveal in the book, but that would be equally or more shocking to Americans?
Yeah. Well, look, when I wrote the book, I was very clear in my own mind I was not going to reveal classified information. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of years in my career trying to advance the national security interest of the United States. And the last thing that I wanted to do was give advantage to foreign adversaries. Much of what happens in the book is embarrassing the president, but that doesn't make it classified by any stretch of the imagination. The president's not worried about foreigners reading the book. He's worried about Americans reading the book. Mm-hmm. You know, it may have been a bit of a stretch to say I could fill 500 more pages with classified information, but the fact is a lot of what's in there now could have been expanded. And in 25 or 50 years, when it's all declassified, maybe I'll write a new edition of the book that puts it all in there. People will find out about it at some point, and it won't make Trump look any better.
Once again, without going into details or anything that might be classified, in your opinion, or based on what you've witnessed, do you think this president has ever come close to starting a war?
Certainly not in my experience. I think any number of outside commentators have written about the propensity to bluster, but then not to take hard action. A lot of this is wanting to have it both ways. A lot of it is just not fully understanding what the factors are that he needs to take into account. In an early chapter, I talk about something happened in my first week on the job. Syria had killed its own civilians using chemical weapons. The United States retaliated 6 days into my tenure in the job. The decision-making process was not what it should have been. And I think in part, substantial part, it was because the president just didn't like having to make the decision. He knew he had to make it, but he didn't want to.
Well, Ambassador Bolton, I know you have to go. So before we wrap up, I have to ask you about the recent report that Russia offered the Taliban cash bounties for killing U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. The president has tried to throw cold water on that story, claiming that the intelligence isn't credible or even going so far as to call it a hoax. Do you buy his story?
Well, talking about the intelligence of 2020, you know, we've had Secretary of Defense Esper and others say that there was intelligence about this reward for killing Americans. There may not have been intelligence that Americans were actually killed by Taliban or that rewards or bounties were actually paid, but it was sufficiently serious to alert our allies in Afghanistan for force protection. Mm-hmm. Purposes. What I think is the information that we get through intelligence is never 100% verified, but this threat coming from a nuclear power, definitely something the president should have heard about.
I should certainly think so. Very, very concerning. Well, once again, John Bolton's book is called The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Ambassador John Bolton, thanks for talking with me.
Well, thanks again for having me.
Thanks again to John Bolton for coming on the podcast. Once more, you can order his book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. You can also follow him on Twitter at @AMBJohnBolton. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.